He's an active duty law enforcement officer, a SWAT team member. He's here to talk about the most violent mass shooting in the history of the United States, other traumatic events, how it impacted him, his career, and how it moves him forward. Welcome to the Law Enforcement Talk Radio Show. In the Law Enforcement Talk Radio Show, we are joined by special guests talking about their experiences, the realities of investigating crimes, plus those who have experienced horrendous trauma. Police, first responders, military, and victims of crime share their stories. Hi, I'm John J. Wiley. In addition to being a broadcaster, I'm also a retired police sergeant. Be sure to check out our website, letradio.com, and also like us on Facebook. Search for the Law Enforcement Talk Radio Show. Get access to free podcast versions of the show and more on Facebook. Do a search for the Law Enforcement Talk Radio Show and be sure to click like. Joining us on the Law Enforcement Talk Radio Show, we have Alan Goodrich. Alan is a career law enforcement officer. He has been part of a police department in, let's just say, Nevada. And he's been part of SWAT team, and he's been on since 2006. He is author of the book, October Strong. And the website is octoberstrong.com. Alan, thanks so much for being a guest on the show. Telling your story, very much appreciated.
Thank you, John. I'm glad to be here, sir.
The good thing about this is we don't really often get a chance to talk to law enforcement officers about what happened. And I want to set the table so people realize this. There's a lot of things that Alan can't talk about. And that's departmental rules. Every agency is this way across the United States. It's not a negative thing. We could talk forever about what's the pros and cons of it. But the main reason why is you still have court cases. You still have litigation going on. You have all these things. And they want a unified message. So normally it's put out by public information officers. And officers are not allowed to talk to the media about specifics when it comes to certain cases. Did I handle that correctly?
Yes, sir. You know, that's right on point. The department's very transparent on the investigation and what happened that day. And we're similar to every other department, but the actions of what I did or what I experienced that day, I'm free and more than open about it. The specifics of the case, you know, we better than anybody. It's just,
we act
on our own, not as a representative.
Right.
So you're right on the money.
We could make it an argument all day long that part of the problem with the public's perception about policing is that we don't tell enough of the stories about the heroics that police do. And that's part of the reason why I started this show. We say things and we're as guilty. I say we, that means police officers, active, retired. You know, I just do my job, and departments are quick to throw people under the bus, but they're not quick to stand up and say they did the right things. And I'm not asking you to comment. That's just my observation. So maybe if we did a little more of this, people would have a more realistic view of what goes on and what happens. I'm not an expert when it comes to mass shootings. I don't profess to be one. I do have a simple philosophy that I will never give publicity to mass killers, their names, their reasons, their manifestos, none of that stuff. We'll talk about victims. We'll talk about officers. We'll talk about the heroes that stood up and did their job. I do want to say this. The Mandalay Bay shooting in Las Vegas, I can't see anything that department could have done differently. There's lots of Monday morning quarterbacks that love to criticize and comfort of the safety of their office. They weren't there. And there's lots of police officers that say, well, if I was there, I'd have done this. And I reply, you weren't there. So shut it. And let's hear from the people that were. And I want to say this. I've been retired from policing a long time. And we learned lots of things. And this was when I retired in 92. We didn't have a lot of things we're talking about now. We did things that we didn't have the terms critical incidents. We didn't have stress debriefing. We didn't have all that stuff. We didn't have peer support. That was in the infancy stages. We just did the best we could with what we had. And there was intense training. And I got to say this for all the men and women that were there, law enforcement officers from every agency, the other first responders, firefighters, EMTs, the military. My hat's off them. They did an awesome job.
Well, we thank you very much. And I think you nailed it right on the point where you said that, a lot of departments, you know, it's not that they're not explaining things. Like they're very transparent about the facts of the case and the details of the case. Like none of that's been hidden. But what you're right, absolutely, is that a lot of times what gets overlooked is like, what was it like for me? What was it like for my partner? What was it like for us to be out there that day? And you're right, your show and your radio show is definitely a good avenue for people to get in our minds and our hearts and feel like what that day actually felt like and what we were thinking and what was going on in our heads while this was going on. That's something we don't talk about. You know, they'll have these briefings and these public disclosures where they'll talk about the facts of the case, but they don't tell you about what it looked like, what it smelled like, what it felt like, you know, from our point of view, because I mean, that's important for the public to understand of how we responded to things, of what it felt like for us. They're just giving facts so we can appreciate what they're doing, but the public doesn't get to see things from our point of view because they weren't there, and then that doesn't get talked about.
Right. It doesn't get talked about. And one of the things, I had a guest on a show, on the Law Enforcement Talk Radio show in the past. I believe he was a Henderson police officer that was there. And one of the things he talked about was the image in his mind of curtains flopping through the window. Every time he encountered a window after that was open that had curtains or whatever it was flopping through, it immediately took him right back to that. The response, the physiological response was immediate.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I can to this day remember in great detail a lot of the stuff that was going on that day. And, you know, I would like to think, you know, I get to travel the country and meet a lot of police departments through a side job I have, and I'm super blessed to have this job. So I get to meet a lot of cops all through the nation, and I don't mean in any disrespect to any other departments, but I would definitely say that being on Las Vegas's police department, we are very highly trained comparably to most departments. Yeah. And we're really spoiled and blessed to have a lot of tools we have and command staff we have that supports us and gives a about us. So it's very spoiled, but we're on top of all that training. When an incident like that happens, you know, you'd mentioned that you don't know if we could have responded any better. I agree. We were, you know, I just remember going into action mode and just doing what I was trained. And you're not thinking, you're not analyzing, you're just doing your job. And so being a part of Vegas, a lot of things just kind of went into play because of how we were trained and how we were supposed to do certain things. But to this day, you know, you talked about the guy with the curtains blowing in the wind. I can still remember, you know, snapshots of that day of walking into certain hotels and clearing certain places and just certain smells and certain sights and seeing certain people just sticks with you forever.
It does. And I really want to understand this. And one of the things that took me for years, honestly, Alan, and you don't have to respond to this, was the coulda, shoulda, woulda thing, and the guilt that I should have done this differently. If I was Superman, I would. Well, the truth is, I'm not Superman. I wasn't God.
Yeah.
I just did the best I could with what tools I had. And remember, I'm an old revolver cop. It's not like we didn't have rifles. We didn't have patrol rifles. We didn't have a lot of things that are second nature nowadays. We did the best we could with what we had. And it's so easy to sit there and say, well, they should have done this. Well, the truth is, and a lot of this conversation, Alan has to be quiet about. It's me getting on my soapbox. A lot of the things is a deep pocket syndrome. They'll say, well, you know, the department should have done this. They could have done this. They could have done that. They could have done this. Well, the truth is, when the call is dispatched, and the reality is, you just do the best you can. And you cannot, I don't care who the aggressor is, you cannot do anything until you get them on a defensive posture. This is the Law Enforcement Talk Radio Show. We'll return our conversation with Alan Goodrich. He is a active duty police officer, a SWAT team officer, author of the book October Strong. His website is octoberstrong.com. Be sure to follow the Law Enforcement Talk Radio Show and podcast on the Newsbreak app. Newsbreak is your number one local news app for current events, free live news for you and your community. Download the Newsbreak app today for free and be sure to follow the Law Enforcement Talk Radio Show and podcast on the Newsbreak app. When we return, we're going to talk more about the trauma he went through as a police officer and much more. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Remember when news was free? Be sure to check out the Newsbreak app. It's free. And be sure to follow the Law Enforcement Talk radio show and podcast on the Newsbreak app. Newsbreak is your number one local news app for current events, free live news for you and your community. Download the Newsbreak app today for free. And be sure to follow the Law Enforcement Talk radio show and podcast on the Newsbreak app. That's the free Newsbreak app. Be sure to look for and follow the Law Enforcement Talk radio show and podcast. We're returning our conversation on the Law Enforcement Talk radio show with Alan Goodrich. He's an active duty police officer, SWAT team member, and has been since 2006, and he's author of the book October Strong. The website is octoberstrong.com. Now, without getting into specifics, part of your job was the Mandalay Bay mass shooting. And when I say mass shooting, if my memory is correct, this is the most violent, the biggest body count of any shooting ever in the United States. Am I wrong?
No, you're correct.
And it took place at Mandalay Bay Hotel, and the suspect, who we won't name, was firing on concert goers not too far away. Am I correct on that?
Yeah. So at that time, I was not a SWAT officer. It was just before my SWAT career kicked off. I was just a generalized police detective. We call them patrol detective or PD. It happened to be and before I get into it too much, John, my story in what happened on that day is not unique. I'm not going to beat my chest and pretend like I'm some hero. I work around a lot of heroes who have a lot of credit due, and I would never want to take any way actions or heroic actions by these folks. But my impact on the event was very minimal. But what I did do was I remember it was my day off. I remember, like I said, we talked a little bit earlier about how some things just stick with you. I remember very vividly sitting on my couch at home on my day off, and I get a text message from a good friend of mine who was a police officer in that local precinct. And the text message was very short. It was just something similar to like, "Hey, active shooter on the strip," and that was it. And I remember as soon as I saw that, I picked up my radio I had at home. I flipped it on, and I could just hear the chaos on the radio. And I couldn't, develop what exactly was happening. Just you could hear lots of people talking, lots of people shot, and I really didn't know a whole lot was going on. So I stood up. I said goodbye to my family. It was my day off, and I ran to the door. I jumped on a motorcycle of mine that's a little high performance and probably drove a little fast, if you will. I drove to my station on my motorcycle, which was pretty close to my house. And as I pulled up to the station, I ran in my office, my little detective cubicle. I grabbed the little tack vest I had and my rifle, and I ran out of my office. And as soon as I ran out of my office, I came into contact with a bunch of different buddies of mine who are also detectives, but they were working that day. And I just jumped in the passenger seat of the sergeant of that team, and we just went down there. And I remember as we were headed towards the area, just all the radio traffic going on about different people shot, needing, ambulances, needing medical, people not knowing where it was coming from. It was all very evolving on the radio. And long story short, basically we were getting conflicting information from different officers reporting different things, which is understandable, And
the fog of war, they say. There's so much going on. The fog of war, they say. There's so much going on, you can't tell. That's why facts always change.
Yeah, and they're constantly, the facts aren't presented in a final mode. It's just kind of, we think this and we think that and we think this. And so we, at the beginning, we didn't know if it was multiple shooters or multiple locations, because there were so many victims running in all sorts of directions, running into all sorts of different casinos and hotels. We really didn't know where or how many or anything, just that it's just chaos. So in my mind, I remember just thinking, like, you know, I remember the training from active shooters and stuff in my younger years about the Mumbai, you know, terrorist attacks with coordinated multiple efforts. And that's kind of the image that's going through your brain when this is happening. So in my mind, I'm visioning, you know, shooters on the ground level, shooters in the hotel, shooters on the, you know, airport, shooters at different locations. So that's kind of where we're preparing our mind for, because of the vast amount of, you know, casualties that we were hearing reported on the radio. So as we're driving, my boss that I was with kind of took the back way to the strip. There's a kind of a side street that circles the employee entrance and such. And so we were getting radio calls of this hotel and that hotel and this hotel. And so we would just take hotels one by one and run in there with our rifles and kind of just try and put a fire team together and work our way through the casino, looking for what we thought was an active shooter at any possible location. And while we were doing that, you know, we came into contact with, you know, a lot of victims who had been hit in the arm or leg or somebody carrying somebody.
And people need to realize this. This suspect fired more than 1,000 rounds. I'm reading from Wikipedia. Killing 60 people and wounding at least 413. That is massive casualties on a huge scale. I can't even begin to comprehend it.
Yeah, and it's kind of, you know, when you're in that work mode, if you will, it's kind of you leave your emotions aside and you act as you've been trained, and we've been trained well. So as we're in this fire team working our way through these casinos, I remember to this day just seeing people, you know, running past trying to find security or trying to find medical, people coming up to us, you know, asking for an ambulance. And while this is going on, people are running everywhere. There's blood, you know, people grabbing their arms, their legs, people with loved ones. I remember, like, there were patrons of the casino kind of, like, looking around as if it were just, like a movie being filmed, you know? Just deer in the headlights kind of looking around like, what is this? Oh, well, hit me, you know? I'll take another hand, you know? Very, very weird few moments right at the beginning.
And there's no rule book written on this. And I got to interrupt very quickly, because what would go through my mind, and you said a couple things. Number one, you really don't get a chance to think a whole lot beforehand. It's more on autopilot, more on your training. I do remember going through a little checklist in my mind, do this, this, and this, you know, and I didn't. I always tell people I prayed many times in a patrol car, but it was never for calls like this. It was like going to drug raids, stuff I knew ahead of time could be potentially violent. But when these things occur, they happen fast. One of the things that is important was you were off duty. You heard about this, and you didn't hesitate to drive into work to take action. And you weren't alone. There's a lot of people there that did that.
Yeah, like. I remember running into guys on my shift who I knew was their days off. So it was nothing unique. It was just that situation where you knew it was going down. Grab your gear. Let's go.
Yeah. And without a thought, and you said goodbye to your family and you took off, and you really didn't know what you're getting into. All you knew was there was a mass shooter on a strip. That was it. You didn't know anything else, did you?
No. And you know, we had officers at the concert, you know, who were patrons of the concert when this would kick off, who also turned into work mode. You know, they're like, okay, let's stop this threat. Let's get people safe. Let's get people to safety. Let's get people medical attention. I know lots of good friends of mine who went into work mode. In fact, one of our fallen officers was one of those individuals who turned into work mode and died a hero from helping people get to safety. Yep. And rendering medical aid and was killed in that incident. So, a lot of people just switched from, hey, it's a concert, we're enjoying music, to time to work.
That's exactly right. And it's like flipping a switch. And we'll get into that conversation in a few moments. We're talking with Alan Goodrich. Alan is an active duty law enforcement officer, SWAT team member for an agency in Nevada. He's author of the book October Strong. Website is octoberstrong.com. When we return, we'll talk more about the Mandalay Bay mass shooting, other critical incidents he's involved in, and much more. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Of all the radio stations in the United States, there are no other shows like the Law Enforcement Talk Radio Show. And on Facebook, there's only one official page. Do a search on Facebook for the Law Enforcement Talk Radio Show. And be sure to like the Law Enforcement Talk Radio Show Facebook page. return conversation with Alan Goodrich on the Law Enforcement Talk Radio Show. Alan is an active duty law enforcement officer, police officer, SWAT team member for a large agency in Nevada. And he was one of the officers on scene for the Mandalay Bay mass shooting. And he was off duty when he heard about it. He rushed in the station and took action. He's written a book called October Strong, which we'll talk about later on. His website is octoberstrong.com. Because, by the way, this happened October 1st, I think it was 2017. It's hard to believe it was that long ago.
Yeah, it feels very, very recent. But yeah, it was a little bit while ago.
Yeah, it was. But here's something you said earlier. The after effects. And the other guest I had on, the Henderson, Nevada police officer, he's now out of law enforcement. He talks about how certain things from that incident will stay with him and trigger immediate responses. And I want people to realize this, that I can't imagine what the officers went through that were there. I went through my own sort of special bad stuff, and I was affected and I'm still affected. My daughters are affected. My current wife is affected. My family members are affected as well. Having said that, it doesn't matter what caused these things to be this way. It's my responsibility to deal with it. So there is light at the end of the tunnel. I'll just say that. There's a lot of light at the end of the tunnel. So you're at Mandalay Bay. You are there. And really, you don't know what's going on, but that doesn't stop you from doing your job to try to find out.
No, we really didn't know what was going on for a little while. And like you said, these things affect you and they stay with you. But the reason why we train so rigorously is that the reason for the training is that so that does not affect you at that moment.
Right.
You know,
it doesn't stop you from doing your job. You got to go.
No.
We always said this. You know, and I hate it. It sounds really crass to say, suck it up, buttercup. You're the police. You got a job to do. You can lick your wounds later on.
Yeah. And I've been in quite a few critical incidences, as we call them. But when those things happen, and this one's no different, when you go into that work mode, it's automatic. You're almost, if you can imagine, you're almost in an out-of-body experience, watching yourself operate, watching yourself move, watching yourself make decisions that are just second nature that fall back on your training. So these things, they will affect you, and they do affect you and to various degrees for different people. But at that moment, you know, you don't know what's going on. You don't know what's happening. All I know are people are dying. People need help, and a threat needs to be stopped. It needs to be stopped right now. And I just hope to God that I get to be the guy that gets to do that. So we're looking aggressively. We're trying to save people, and we're trying to make things safe right now. And then everything else along the line we can handle later. You know, we can do our investigations and make the scene safe and that kind of stuff. But we're looking to stop this aggressive threat right now. That's what's on everybody's mind.
And I want to reflect back to the Wikipedia site. This occurred October 1st, 2017. It was a mass shooting. I'm not going to say the shooter's name because I don't believe in doing that. He fired from the Mandalay Bay Hotel to Route 91 Harvest Music Festival that was taking place below. 60 people were killed and 413 at least were wounded, and the suspect fired more than 1,000 rounds. It was, from my imagination, I can't. Well, here's a good example. People hear backfires, they hear fireworks, and they freak out. They think it's a gun. I don't. When I hear a gun, I know it's a gun very quickly. But when you have people and all these buildings around, sound echoes, and you really can't tell where it's coming from, and your mind doesn't go upwards to where this hotel room where the shooter was at, did it?
No, you can. I mean, by the time I had gotten to the scene, the firing had stopped, but with the chaos that was going on, we didn't know that it had stopped. But I can definitely understand from those people's perspective, especially the officers who were at the concert and on the floor when it was going on. I can understand completely the unknowing and the not knowing of where, or, you know, what or how much. That's not far-fetched to understand that you don't know.
No. And that doesn't stop you from doing. I want to repeat this. That doesn't stop them from doing their job.
Absolutely not.
Knowing that there is a tremendous possibility that you could lose your life, and I'm going to ask you this point blank. I was aware that this job could be violent. I was aware that officers were killed. I knew some officers that were killed. That thought never entered my mind. If it did, I'd never leave the patrol car. That would never happen to me. Did that thought happen to you when you arrived on a scene or incidents after?
No, you're 100% on point. You know what? It's not something you're thinking of there. It's something that will hit you later, you know, days, weeks, years later, and you know, other critical incidents as well. But that thought's definitely not going through your head while you're in an incident like that. You're literally hyper-focused on just stopping the threat and helping other people out. It's not even a concern. And I'll speak for myself, but probably, I don't want to say everybody, but I would say 99.999999%. That's the case. We're out there, you know, not to say we're, you know, Superman or nothing like that, but everyone out there is literally just trying to save people and stop the threat.
And now what, change direction a little bit. When you went back home, now all of a sudden, and this is part of the problem I ran into for a very long time. I did very well with this. I was Cop J, and then when I take the soft body armor off, create the Velcro opening, I would psychologically transition into Husband J and Father J and all that stuff. And I did great with that for a very long time until I tell people, until things got really quiet when I was retired, and then I had nothing but time to think. So you get done, you go home, and it's like business as usual. You're supposed to be the same Alan you've always been. Is that correct?
Yeah, and that's you're 100% right. And that's one thing I really wish the public who are not in our shoes or don't have family members, or even for our family members who are close to us, they don't really grasp that. Is you go through an incident like that, and you see what you see, you feel what you feel, you hear what you hear. And then you go home, and then all of a sudden you're supposed to be dad and brother and, you know, mother, sister. Like, it just doesn't work that way very well. And I know some people do a great job of handling it, but, you know, switching that hat as soon as you walk in, like, it's not an easy task to do. And, you know, maybe if we stay busy, you're at games with your kids or you're doing something, it's easy. But you're right, when it gets quiet, it's tough to take that hat off for a moment. I remember a couple things that really just irritated me in the aftermath. And, you know, aside from the personal stuff that I had to deal with, was you know, turning on the news and hearing the number, you know, 58, 59, 60. I was just furious because, like I said, my help in the investigation with that was pretty minimal, but I had to go back to my regular duties the next few days as a detective, and there were a couple times where I had to go to the hospital and interview somebody for a completely unrelated case, and I would walk the halls of these hospitals, and this was the next couple days of these big hospitals crowded with these victims who are clinging to life, and I would just meet their families, give them a hug, talk to them, speak with them, and then I would go home and turn on the news, and it was a number. And I was just infuriated that the news would just say, you know, 58, 59, 58, 59, 60. And I'm like, this is not, I didn't talk to 57. I didn't talk to 54. I was talking with Tammy Smith or, you know, Marcus, whatever. Like, these are people. These are mothers, fathers, right, brothers, sisters, cousins. These aren't numbers. And so I just was pulling my hair out that the news would just put a number to it.
And yet they will go at length ad nauseum about who the shooter was and their motivations, sure, and their manifestos and all that stuff. We're talking with Alan Goodrich. He's an active duty law enforcement officer in the state of Nevada. He's authored the book October Strong. The website is octoberstrong.com. When we return, we're going to talk a little bit more about other critical incidents he was involved in and the impact it's had on him, and most importantly, how it motivates him to do what he does today. This is Law Enforcement Talk Radio Show. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. If you want to be a guest on the Law Enforcement Talk radio show, simply contact us. It couldn't be easier. You can send us a message on Facebook. Look for and like the Law Enforcement Talk radio show page or email jay@letradio.com. That's jay@letradio.com. During conversation with Alan Goodrich on the Law Enforcement Talk radio show. Alan is a full-time police officer, career officer in the state of Nevada. And he's been on a job since 2006. He is author of the book, October Strong, about the Mandalay Bay mass shooting, which we'll talk about in a few moments. And his website is octoberstrong.com. He's now a SWAT team member, which we'll talk about in just a moment. Alan, before you went into the beginning of this story, you talked about you were we called a district detective or a patrol detective, and you weren't a SWAT team member yet, and you were off duty, and you heard about the mass shooting, and you went to Mandalay Bay. And by the way, more than 1,000 rounds were fired, 60 people killed, and at least 413 injured. It stands as a landmark and the deadliest mass shooting in American history. And you said repeatedly, and I get it, brother, I get it, where it's like, I wasn't a hero, my impact was minimal, but you showed up, you did your job. That's admirable. And one of the things I tell people all the time, they're like, for example, military. I was a mechanic and I didn't get sent to the combat. That's not your call. Sometimes it has to do with fate. Look, there were times where I was totally unexpecting something bad to happen, and I was in a fight for my life within seconds after that. And I didn't see it coming. So the heroic part, I appreciate it, but you're preaching to the choir. All right? So I want you to tell everybody that was there, I appreciate what they did, and I appreciate what they do, and I appreciate how they try to carry themselves and lick their wounds afterwards. So going back to you go home, and it's back to one of the things I had, and this is, you kind of alluded to this. You started getting really angry when you were interviewing other people, and the news media kept referring to them as numbers and they're real people. One of my biggest problems is I got so angry that it was like someone flipped a switch. I would go from totally calm to out of my mind, and I'm not that way anymore. But that was a real issue. And when I see body cam videos of cops who they were choir boys, they were great, they did this and that, 4 or 5 years on job, and then all of a sudden they're screaming at people and they're acting like idiots, and I say, that's a wounded person there and needs our help. How badly were you affected by all this?
Well, I look back on that specific day, and to be honest with you, it was pretty surreal. I don't think that was the day that I could pin some of my struggles on, per se. I do think it, you know better than most, and you know exactly what I'm talking about, but just to describe it to your listeners, like, you have a cup, and over your career, it just fills with water.
Right.
And there comes a point where there's just too much water, and it either tips over, or it just starts to overflow. I think that was a big filler of my cup, but that probably was not the tipping point in my career where I started to really have personal problems and spiral downhill. But that was a big factor to add to the whole accumulation of a, 18 year career at this point. It's just that, I don't think that was the day that did it for me, but that was definitely a big impact on where my struggles began.
The cup is a great analogy. I use the analogy of the backpack. You're given a state-of-the-art backpack in the academy at that time, and every call you go to, you pick up a pebble. Sometimes they're big, sometimes they're small. And it's usually, if you don't find a way to get rid of some of those pebbles and deal with it better, there's one that's going to break and devastate you and devastate that backpack, and it's going to spew everywhere. And that's unfortunate what happens with lots of police. When I say police, that means law enforcement, deputy sheriff, state troopers, whatever we're going to be. For me, it was a cumulative effect. And I said this earlier. It was on the job. I knew what to do. I knew what my role was. I knew the things I needed to do. I was very good at what I did. It was when I got home that things started to spiral out of control, where I was like, I don't want to be this guy. I never wanted to be this guy. I never planned to be this guy.
Yeah, 100%. And I think the hardest part is while you and I went through that and we become something that we didn't anticipate, you know, when you're in the academy, you're bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, you're given that new backpack and you're ready to conquer the world. And then as those rocks start thrown in your backpack, people around you notice it, that you've changed. You know, maybe you may not go to these parties or these Christmas events or these family events, and you start to pull away and your family looks at you and they're like, what is wrong with you? And you look at yourself in the mirror and you're like, what is wrong with me?
What's wrong with me? What happened? Where did that guy go? Yeah,
exactly. Where was that optimist that I grew up with, and why is he act this way? And the answer is, I don't know. So how can I expect you to know? Maybe if you don't know, how about just understand and just give me a hug and say, I'm here if you need me.
Right. And see, the thing is, I'm not going to talk to you about this stuff. And I wouldn't talk to a lot of other police unless they've been through it. And it's not that I'm selective. It's just I hated the questions and I still don't like the questions. So look, for example, and I'm sure we've all had this. You go to a cookout and someone's drinking beer and they come up and ask you a stupid question. Have you ever shot anybody?
Yep. Yeah, that's a...
At first I was very nice, and then years later it's like, I go, yeah, and I don't feel like about having that conversation about the one of the worst moments of my life with someone I don't know.
And the unfortunate part is your friends who don't understand the job, they want you to explain, tell me about the shootout, and tell me about that car chase,
right.
And you're like, I don't want to, dude, and give me my space.
Look, you're not asking for a lot from a guy like me who understands that. The people who don't know, and it took me a long time to realize this. Maybe you have, maybe you haven't. People have good intentions. They don't mean harm, the vast majority of them. They just really are curious, and they don't know of anybody else to ask, and you happen to be close, so they're going to ask you.
Yeah, I definitely see what you're saying, and I think that's a very mature perspective to take, because they aren't asking these questions to get under your skin. They're asking it because they are curious, or maybe they even care. And you'd mentioned earlier that when you were a police officer, it was, you know, the infancy stages of peer support groups and that kind of thing. And I know we all want to be just tough and stuff, but there are guys who are in pain and hurting. And I'm at the point in my career, and I think we're getting to the point in policing where this is becoming, I don't want to say a problem, but it's definitely an issue that departments are recognizing, looking at, and they're trying to get ahead of these problems. And they're not perfect. You know, we have peer support groups and programs set up that are not just a silver bullet fix everything, but they're learning and they're trying to get better. And I think the intent is there so that we can handle these things. And guys just, you know, understand that these people are asking you questions because they probably care or because they maybe want to be entertained by a story. But for you on the other side being asked that stuff, you know, maybe we don't want to talk about it. Maybe we don't want to relive that moment.
But you decided to write about it. So I got to ask you this. What in God's name possessed you to write a book?
Well, thank you for asking that. The straw that broke my camel's back, if you will, was a shooting I was involved in. And without getting too much into it, just kind of general understanding. When I was on the SWAT team, we had a hostage rescue situation. And basically, to resolve the situation, I was put in a position where I took a young man's life. And being on the SWAT team and going through the incident, it was pretty, you know, clear cut and dry. I made a decision that everyone else would have done the same thing, but you're put on administrative leave as part of a routine after the fact.
Right.
And I spent, you know, the next few months going to this doctor, and they, you know, they evaluate you, and you have to talk to this person and talk to that doctor. And I thought I was handling it well. You know, on the outside, I was, you know, I looked good and I talked to people. I'm fine, you know, everything's good. But deep down inside, when those quiet moments would hit, John, like you were talking about, you know, I would just spiral out of control into drinking and, I don't know if I would call it depression, but just, I would just say dark moments, you know?
Well, I'll say this, Alan, when, if you pour enough alcohol down your throat, which is a depressant, which is what I did, you're going to have symptoms. And one of the biggest things, best things ever to me was getting sober, and which I did more than 30 years ago. And I don't, to this day, understand the correlation between trauma and alcohol, but I just know it's like throwing gasoline on a fire. We're almost out of time. The name of your book is October Strong. Where can people get more information about it?
They can get it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. They can get it on the website, octoberstrong.com. Anywhere that that sells it on the website is fine. So Amazon's probably the best option, though.
And if they want to get in touch with you, can they do that at octoberstrong.com?
Yep, they there's a way they can get a hold of me on the website, or you know, I'm not real big on social media, but we do have some LinkedIn stuff that they can also contact me on LinkedIn.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Alan. Appreciate your service and really appreciate you telling your story on the Law Enforcement Talk Radio Show.
Thank you, John.
I'd like to thank our guests for coming on the Law Enforcement Talk Radio Show. The Law Enforcement Talk Radio Show is a nationally syndicated weekly radio show broadcast on numerous AM and FM radio stations across the country. We're always adding more affiliate stations. If you enjoyed the podcast version of the show, which is always free, please do me a favor and tell a friend or two or three. I'll be back in just a few days with another episode of the Law Enforcement Talk Radio Show and podcast. Until then, this is John J. Wiley. See ya.